Still Life, a Battlestar Galactica fanfic by Munditia, read by Sophonisba. This is a genfic featuring Anastasia Duala and Kara Thrace. Summary. If she'd been more like Starbuck, she could have been loud and angry and looking for a fight. But she was a follower of Hestia and Hebe, a quiet onlooker trying to keep the home fires burning. Still Life. From her bedroom window, Anna glimpsed sun and sky first thing in the morning. On a good day, they would blind her with liquid blue and gold, brighter than the stars on her wallpaper, tangerine and lemon. On bad days, she would see only indistinct shapes in the smog over Sagittarion City. It was the good days that stayed with her, early memories of climbing from bed to windowsill to stare at an industrial cityscape transformed by light and color. Sometimes, when her grandparents or her dad asked her to draw a picture, she'd try to paint the view. It never looked quite right, but they would give her a kiss for her efforts. They didn't want her to draw Mom in a broken car, red light ketchup and fire engines. Anna knew that, although they didn't say it out loud. She would sit in a corner, unnoticed, listening to everything her family talked about. Listening was something she was good at, listening and observing. Far better than at painting, it seemed. Whenever she gave her best to impress her arts and crafts teachers, it was not good enough. Neat, but too static, her teacher scribbled on her sketch of her room and gave her a B-. The goddess Hestia, wrapped in purple cloth, once her grandma's best tea towel, crumbled because the clay was too dry. When Anastasia went wild with her paint box, dabbing azure, cerulean, and school bus yellow on the paper, she received a question mark under her title, Helios Rising from Okeanos. She cried that night, after putting so much work into the painting. Her father handed her a tissue and told her to blow her nose. "It's a good picture, Anna," he said. "Nice colors. But you're not going to grow up to be an artist, not if you're from Sagittarion. Manual labor, that's our pride." Dad's rough palm glided over her tear-streaked face. "Or used to be. You're a smart girl, Anna. Your brain's your capital. Don't waste it." During her lessons, she'd sit quietly, listen attentively, and copy the notes on the whiteboard. Her teachers smiled, failing to notice the way her pink felt-tip pen flew over page after page. Concentric circles filled the margins. Acanthus leaves were entwined around the lines. Rosettes bloomed between meandering rivers. The designs were popular among her friends. Anna had to decorate plaster casts from sport injuries and sticker books and pencil cases. One day, her computer science teacher caught her sketching a card for Thesmophoria, glittering seeds red as rubies in the white pulp of a cleft pomegranate. She blushed when he snatched the draft and asked her to see him during lunch break. "You're a good student, Anastasia," he said. "Diligent, above average grades in most tech classes, obviously adept at multitasking. Since you have vocational counseling scheduled for next month, you might as well consider this." The leaflet urged her to join the colonial forces, appealing to her patriotism and mentioning a scholarship for a military university. Anastasia skimmed the text while her eyes kept straying to the photos of Caprica's capital, elegant buildings in ochre, beige, pale taupe, topped with spires of steel blue. Her family wouldn't like it, and yet she asked the counselor for the nearest recruitment office 4 weeks later. Anna's father reminded her of their altar, where there was no place for Ares, and where the warrior maidens, Athena and Artemis, were not revered. Of her grandmother's years in the labor camp after the strike, when her back broke before her time. Of his job in the arms factory, producing grenades to blow up machines until he became one himself. His voice grew louder and louder. For the first time in her life, she heard him, soft-spoken and kind, shout and yell, harangues dripping from his lips like spittle. She pressed her burning eyes shut, wishing she could shut out his voice, too. Tiny specks of light were dancing behind her lids, industrial floodlights, electric blue in a winter's dawn, orange blazing like Xerox bombs, the rich carmine of her best friend's fingernails, polished for an interview at the temp agency downtown. Anna drew a slow breath and focused on the posters she'd passed on her way to the recruiter. Before her mind's eye, the travel ad's impossible colors became so bright that she lost herself in Aquaria's ivory beaches and turquoise oceans. "I made up my mind, Dad," Anastasia said. On her first leave from the academy, she did go to Aquaria, determined to spend every hard-earned credit of her military scholarship on beach clubs and neon cocktails with sparkling umbrellas. She could see the coast from the balcony of her rundown hostel, and she included little sketches on the cards for her grandparents. To her father, she sent a few sentences, polite to the point of painfulness. This didn't change over the years. After hearing about her first assignment as a communications officer on the Bridge of Galactica, Anna drew the ship for her grandma in the old folks' home, its metal gray a sharp contrast to the light blue and forest green of the planet below. The aged woman asked the nurse to buy a frame and hang it on the wall. Anna suspected her father would tear it down soon. The picture was gleaming in the afternoon's amber haze as she left Sagittarion behind, and her new commander was said to be a kind man, warm and paternal despite his gruffness. She wasn't quite prepared for how cold the Battlestar in orbit looked, cold and blank. And way too big and confusing, she thought, when ambling through a maze of crowded corridors. Her kit bag hit the floor with a thud. She turned around to get her bearings. New here, huh? It wasn't a question so much as a statement. She nodded, before remembering she was supposed to be a soldier. Petty Officer Anastasia Duala, reporting for duty, sir, she said, her salute automatic. The other woman was barely older than herself. She looked like anything but a superior officer, sweat-soaked blonde hair plastered to her skull and uniform jacket undone. But then you never knew. That's a mouthful, she said, and laughed. Anastasia smelled cheap liquor and vomit on her breath. CIC's that way. Just take the second corridor on the right and the fifth on the left, D. The officer took off again without a word, not bothering to mention her name. Yeah, frack you too, Anna mouthed at her retreating back. By the time she arrived on the bridge, she had already become D. She learned to put up with that nickname. As Adama once used it to wish her a good morning, off duty in the mess, she grinned despite herself. After a while, she started signing her letters to her grandma with D, adding a tiny cartoon figure for good measure. Small and lithe in a neat blue uniform, with exaggerated earphones on a bubbly head. She'd produce whole comic strips during her night shifts. On a veteran vessel like this, the post of communications officer wasn't exactly the most demanding job. Soon, Dee was able to log inbound and outgoing comms in her sleep. Unless the XO noticed her sideline, she'd be safe. Gaeta flashed her conspiratorial smiles when he spotted her pen, but nobody else got wise to her. Nobody, except for Starbuck. Dee had underestimated her sharp eyes and fast movements. One moment, Starbuck was handing in her sit-rep about squadron maneuvers, looking bored while the XO berated her. Then she brushed past Dee when striding out of the room, giving her an overdramatic wink and barely hiding a grin at Dee's crimson-faced little tie. The next time Dee was dragged along to a game of triad in the rec room, Starbuck greeted her with a brief thumbs up and shoved her a faded pack of cards. When she began to reshuffle them, Dee suddenly stared at her own mirror image in the back of the Princess High Red. The style was similar to those obscene graffiti in the officer's head. This, however, wasn't another anatomically correct caricature. She liked the intense concentration in the bow of her head, in the curve of her arm. Starbuck refused to look at her, banged a half-full bottle on the table and called for some strip-fashion fun. Dee rolled her eyes at Gaeta, who leant back in the opposite chair, languidly stretching out his legs. "Viper jocks," he muttered. "Kind of think they're the Lord's gifts to the 12 colonies." Dee laughed with him. She was still laughing when she stumbled back to her bunk, wrestling her tank top over her head and hopping along on one foot to lace her boots. It didn't come as a surprise that she woke up with a hangover straight from Tartarus and spent her morning off retching into a dirty toilet bowl. The bitter taste of bile in her mouth, she straightened up, pressed her forehead against the cool metal door, and closed her eyes for a second. Opening them again, she faced the close-up of a semi-naked couple, going at it like bunnies. The topless woman bore a striking resemblance to Boomer, while the guy with his head between her tits wore a knuckle-dragger's jumpsuit, like the chief. Dee whistled and reached for the pen she used to carry in one of her uniform pockets. Time to find out if Starbuck could take what she dished out. There were enough time-honored jokes about cockpits, dipsticks, and joyrides to come up with an illustration. The next time they ran into each other, Starbuck grinned broadly. The next time they sat down for cards together, the pilot won 3 full hands, a pair of Dee's pants, and half her savings from that month's pay. But a box of crayons mysteriously found its way into Dee's locker afterwards. I could get used to this life, she thought, as she tried to explain to the quartermaster why she needed another uniform. She'd learned to distinguish the crew's voices on the comms before they gave their call signs. She loved spending her free time on the observation deck, entranced by 12 planets and their moons, a kid's pastel-colored mobile whirling through space. However, she felt like a girl who'd been playing at war on the day the orange-red mushroom clouds erupted below. They blotted out mountains and seas and forests forever. Dee listened to the screams of the lost and the dying on every channel. Her pen stopped moving. Her ink ran dry. The burgundy blotches on her palms looked like dried blood, scabs over fresh wounds. She stood in front of the memorial gallery, and it didn't matter that she was still alive and had kissed a boy in the corridor. She had no proper pictures of her family to put up because she'd forgotten her albums back home on her last leave. Their faces were blurring in her memory already. While she was used to forgetting which color her mother's eyes had been, she now wanted to weep for the fading shape of her granddad's bushy eyebrows. Then there was no more time to weep because they were running, the pace relentless. It cost Dee all her strength not to fall asleep on duty. Some part of herself, deep down, yearned for the Cylons to catch up with them. They'd go up in a big ball of fire, she thought, hysterical laughter rising in her throat. It would be quick, and the gods could keep their fracking afterlife. Rosy gray asphodel be damned. The nothingness of death would come as a relief. No more plotting FTL jumps and securing channels and encrypting messages and broadcasting course corrections until the flashing figures, sickly green, were etched on her eyeballs and her fingers were crawling over the keyboard of their own accord and she was becoming a cog in the machine, with a broken record mouth repeating the same commands over and over and over again. It was Starbuck who kept her sane, ironically enough, for Dee would have described her as off her rocker without a moment's hesitation. Through the heavy calm traffic, she could hear the strain in the pilot's voice, her insults and obscenities. However, her banter and jokes were flowing free, just as during every training maneuver in the past. Dee's lips twitched despite herself whenever the outrageous pun reached CIC. Ty's cheeks reddened while Adama would pretend not to notice, like Dee's father when she swore in her grandma's presence. The commander's face remained impassive, though, until he declared the fleet safe at last. With a heartfelt smile, infinitely weary and infinitely glad, he sent everyone but a skeleton crew to their bunks for some R&R, and Dee found herself beaming back at him. It took her ages to drag herself to her quarters on cramped legs. Sitting on her ass for 5 days had cut off the blood circulation in her limbs. She had to lean against the wall while a numbness in thighs and calves was giving way to a prickling pain. She passed Starbuck and Apollo in the corridor, trying to greet them with a grateful smile as they caught her mid-stumble. There were violet shadows under their eyes. The cag scratched the dirty stubble on his chin. Starbuck's lips were cracked and chafed, but a triumphant grin was painted on her face, as if they just hadn't blown up a vessel with over 1,000 passengers on board. The image of her white teeth gleaming between bleeding lips, stained with scarlet, followed Dee into her sleep. It was reassuring, she concluded, as her head hit the pillow, that Starbuck's mask didn't crack. An idol, a lucky charm, who'd keep on smiling at disaster. Billy, too, helped her get used to that new world without colors, except for flags draped over coffins. He made Dee feel experienced and battle-hardened. His eager, clumsy kisses reminded her of before, of vacation flings on Aquaria when she emerged from a marine pool in a lavender bikini and 3 guys offered to fetch her a fresh towel, buy her a drink, and rub her back with sun lotion. Of high school crushes who took her for dates in the park where they invited her for ice cream and cherry coke. Everybody would pretend it was the most romantic spot on the 12 colonies and they couldn't see the soot on the wilting tea roses. Burying her face in his neck and pressing his sweaty hand to her breasts, she could forget about many things, about the whiteboard count in the president's office, about the fear and exhaustion in everyone's eyes, about Zarek going scot-free while Callie was lying in sick bay, blood-soaked bandages around her stomach, and Dee's nights were haunted by their former neighbor's sobs. Once he'd broken down in her grandma's arms, crying for his baby daughter, killed in the day nursery of the government building, ripped apart by Zarek's bombs. So she preferred to tug at Billy's lower lip with her teeth and to wriggle in his lap until he grew hard beneath her. His blush was barely visible on the badly lit observation deck. When he drew a deep breath and pushed her away, Dee giggled. She mentioned the latest couple of lewd stick figures in the toilet cubicles, and he blushed even more. Cradle Snatcher, they were entitled, courtesy of Starbuck, most likely. And it was a relief to joke about these silly things. Billy's embarrassed squirming was almost enough to make her forget about the vast blackness outside as well. From the corner of her eyes, Dee glimpsed a formation of vipers on patrol. She wondered, in reluctant admiration, how the pilots could stand going out there, into the dark, day after day. The first time the darkness threatened to swallow Starbuck whole, Dee thought, in a bout of superstition, that the altars were crumbling, the gods had veiled their faces, and their luck was running out. She regretted that blasphemy when the CIC erupted in joy and a lost traveler came home again. Maybe she should sacrifice a precious incense stick to the messenger of the blessed gods for giving Starbuck safe passage. She should pray this was a good omen instead of musing if anybody, from the old man to her friend Felix, would ever be as devastated at her being MIA or as happy at her return. Dee buried her jealousy under her pleasure and accompanied the others to sickbay to surprise Starbuck with an impromptu triad tournament. She drew pomegranates on the back of some cards, bright flower petals and seven seeds, the arils enticing and glistening with juice, her way of saying, get well. Starbuck kept the cards when Doc Cottle threw the visitors out, waving goodbye with the High Priestess in her right hand. Dee saw her trace the crayon sketches before the curtain around her bed was drawn. Starbuck's second disappearance went almost unnoticed. In the greater scheme of things, they were far too busy worrying about the enemy wearing their friends' faces, about the dry brown splatter where the old man had bled all over the CIC, about Cylon boarding parties and unrest in the fleet. Dee had long given up on her as she reappeared, not quite a mystical savior, but the same old Kara, a bit thinner, perhaps, a bit more silent, a bit more withdrawn. There were countless rumors about what had happened down on Caprica and Kobol. No matter how horrible it had been, Dee would have given anything for throwing a last look at the ghostly spires of Caprica City, for feeling the grass between Kobol's broken columns under her feet. Her envy flared up again as she heard about a sacred arrow slung over Starbuck's shoulder, a vase painting of the Divine Huntress come to life, about a vision of the night sky over a springtime meadow, vernal, budding, sweet to the senses. These images stayed with Dee and carried her through dark times. She wanted to believe in the promise of blessings and plenty. She dreamed of a land swelling and pregnant with summer's rich increase, even though many others didn't live to see it. Billy wouldn't be buried in fertile soil. She watched his coffin float out through the airlock, a dead boy who wanted to be a hero, far away from home. She went straight from the funeral to sickbay to look after Lee and bumped into Starbuck in front of the door. "May the ferryman take his coins and guide him to the Field of Shadows," Starbuck mumbled. Dee wasn't sure what astonished her more, that she knew the ancient burial of the dead or that she offered Dee her condolences at all. "So say we all," she replied. How is he?" To her even greater surprise, Starbuck shrugged. "Wasn't in there yet. I just wanted to drop in for a sec. I'm on the duty roster for this shift." She turned to go. "If he's awake, tell him..." "Frack, don't say anything. I'll be back and talk to him myself." As far as Dee could tell, she didn't come back for weeks. Starbuck seemed to have disappeared from their lives, vanishing like the graffiti from the head when the cubicles were scrubbed clean. Despite some brief reappearances, Dee got accustomed to not seeing her around. It made no big difference as she left for good to settle on the slate-gray planet below. New Caprica wasn't the garden they had been yearning for. There were no almond copses and pinkish-white bloom, none of Hera's golden apple trees, no fields of wheat and barley sown by the bringer of seasons, nary a springtime meadow to gather bouquets of rose, crocus, and violet, iris, lily, and larkspur. It was Earth that they were promised. Dee would have gladly become a liar, a cheat, and a fraud to stop the fleet from stopping here. But when their opposition failed, she found herself hoping, against all hope, that this colony would flourish nonetheless. The planet looked inhospitable, and she walked the half-empty halls of Pegasus, staring down at Bister continents under charcoal clouds. Sometimes, however, he couldn't help longing for the settlers' lives. During the inauguration ceremony, the sun had broken through. It had transformed the fallow mud into a rich array of colors, auburn and umber, russet, olive, and maroon. Dee had become engaged in the sunlight on the day after, clinging to the comfortable warmth of Lee's body, breathing in his smell of soil and grass and semen all the while, sensing that her prayers to the patron of marriage might be in vain. Starbuck had congratulated her on the engagement, and if Dee hadn't known better, she would have called her expression shame. No, she didn't miss her much, and yet her absence made the ship seem doubly unfamiliar. Although Dee knew about the colonists' hardships, she envied them the open skies, the ground beneath their feet, and the scraggly herbs between the stones. There were still a few crayons among her belongings. Having finished her rounds as XO, Dee sat down to outline the shape of a leaf, a thorny twig, a blade of grass. She would have loved to paint the fragrant meadow under the stars, but Lee no longer talked about it. He, too, had abandoned the home named Earth. After some time, the sketches lost their appeal, and she stashed away her drawing utensils under uniforms and threadbare underwear. Lee had decorated their quarters with an artsy black-and-white calendar he'd found in a trash can, so she spent far too many off-duty shifts staring at photos from the 12 colonies. The vineyards of Leonis sloped down the rolling hills, and the famous labyrinth of the Toron landscape garden loomed over pebbled pathways. Dee hadn't been to either of those planets. She would never know orange and vermilion vines in autumn, or the purplish berries of Sweet Bay. Only shades of gray were left. Both sketchbook and calendar went up in flames with the Pegasus, but Dee considered that a small loss compared to saving their people. The rooms back on Galactica were as cramped as the decks of Pegasus had been empty. She bumped into harrowed civilians and hardened soldiers at each corner. Ty's bloody eye socket glared at her. Gaeta begged her for a secret stash of Virgon beer, and Starbuck was back in her life. At night, Dee dreamed of Earth again. She was lying under the persimmon blossoms of the lotus tree, stuffing herself with date plums, knowing she would stay forever. On some days, these images pursued her every waking minute, while she was decoding signals on the bridge or sitting next to Lee in some makeshift bar. Then she wondered what Starbuck was haunted by, twice as brash as ever and twice as gaunt. Truth be told, Dee didn't have enough compassion to spare to hold her hand or offer her a shoulder to cry on. She might do her duty and risk her own life for that of a comrade, even if said comrade was getting down and dirty with Dee's husband and didn't care who noticed. If she'd been more like Starbuck, she would have been loud and angry and looking for a fight. But she was a follower of Hestia and Hebe, a quiet onlooker trying to keep the home fires burning. She held on to what remained, precious little anyway. Maybe the marriage would be hers. Maybe she could have a kid or two. Maybe, just maybe, she would see them grow up, drawing smiley faces on yellow duty rosters. If they didn't all end up as toaster fodder, bloated bodies, or radioactive ash drifting slowly through unknown systems. As Lee asked for forgiveness, Dee allowed herself some optimism. Hoping for Earth would mean tempting the gods. For the time being, she'd have to make do with small blessings. Starbuck was strangely subdued and polite at every chance encounter. Perhaps this was her way of apologizing. Perhaps she was indeed cracking up under the stress, as rumor had it. Dee once glimpsed her in the pilot's bunk room, bowing over a scrap of paper and doodling with trembling hands. It was on the tip of her tongue to recommend a visit to Doc Cottle ASAP, but she doubted Starbuck would listen. Perhaps she ought to have said something, Dee thought, as she heard Starbuck's last words on the comm. "See you on the other side," she said, the coins for the crossing jingling in the pocket of her flight suit. While Lee returned to the Galactica alone, stunned silence fell in the CIC. Dee saw Colonel Ty stagger. The commander pressed a hand to his mouth as if he was going to be sick. She stared at the octagonal paper before her, an uninviting blank sullied by one ink smear, and hoped her face was just as void. Theirs seemed to be a grief not hers to share. Adama gave her a curt nod when she asked for permission to leave her post. She ran to the hangar bay, knowing that even her husband wouldn't allow her to mourn with him. Lee sat next to her at the funeral, a mute and rigid monument. The attendants flocked past him to express their condolences for the death of his best pilot, They almost believed in their white lies. Only when looking at Dee would they flinch for a split second. She gave them a smile, polite, brave, and empty, the perfect image of a supportive wife, burying the woman her husband had fracked on more than one occasion and had been, was, painfully in love with. Nobody expected her to cry for Starbuck, so Dee didn't. She looked at the vacant altar, no coffin, no flag, because it'd be willful waste to use them for a burial without body. The idols she had found in Kara's locker were shining in the candlelight, deaf to the priest's incantations, laughter-loving goddess, life-giving, gentle, light-bringer, savior, she who soothes. Starbuck smirked at the mourners from between the statues, her face in the photo a mask to the last. For a fleeting moment, Dee wished they had a different picture to remember her by, livelier and more colorful. The graffiti in the head was long gone. She'd already given the crayons from Kara's locker to Hilo and the chief for their kids, and she shouldn't, couldn't, wouldn't grieve. Lee, on the other hand, wouldn't be comforted. He didn't talk about what was on his mind, although Dee thought, full of bitterness, that she'd hazard an entire betting pool with her guesses. She woke up next to a stranger every morning, too many ghosts between them. When Baltar's trial gave her another reason to walk out, she did, releasing a breath she hadn't known she was holding. Her narrow bunk suddenly appeared wide and spacious. She sprawled and stretched her limbs and vowed to dream of an island amidst a sea of stars. It was Starbuck who would show up in her sleep, though. Pomegranate juice was trickling down her chin, and her eyes were alight with bliss. "Then shall the maidens rejoice at the dance," she said, before Dee woke up. Dee wasn't in the least surprised when she returned in the heat of battle. One soul escaped from the underworld, where too many others had fled. She didn't know what to make of this new Kara, though, whether to bow to her as a harbinger of the gods, swift-footed, rosy-fingered, and golden-winged, or to flush her out the nearest airlock and be done with it. She wanted to hate her for bringing Felix back from that fracking latrine ship with a festering stump for a leg, for luring them onwards with the promise of Earth, when Sharon and her daughter weren't the only Cylons in their ranks anymore, for making a truce with the toasters and yet raising their hopes higher and higher. Dee wasn't surprised, either, as she set foot on Earth for the first time and saw a contaminated wasteland on the horizon. Dead rocks and carious teeth, no shelter, no relief. Her knees gave way under the weight of her body, and she threw herself upon the ground, pressing her face to the sodden clay. The fleet stayed, too dazed to go on. Nobody tried to lay a hand on Starbuck or the Cylons, but no one would speak to them. Dee neither knew nor cared where any of them spent their days until she caught Starbuck sneaking into the wreck of the Demetrius, stumbling along like a sleeper in a nightmare. Dee followed her. She blinked into the dim light, her eyes adjusting to the semi-darkness. The deserted corridors stank of shit and urine. No wonder that the fleet, soldiers and civilians alike, hesitated to use the ship as another fallout shelter. Dee did her best to take shallow breaths through her mouth, wrinkling her nose at the stench and playing hopscotch with the brown stains on the floorboards at least kept her from thinking of the black rain outside. She wondered if Starbuck came here for a similar reason, or if she was hiding from everybody's hatred and suffering. Both, maybe. She found her in an empty cabin, fingers dripping blood under the lonely halo of a light bulb. She was painting. The walls were covered in fields of stars, the sooty black dotted with specks of white, an orange comet trailing past the swirling colors of a gas giant. In rings of dancers, girls in saffron and coral dresses, holding hands and stomping the ground in celebration, their hair fluttering in the breeze. It was the green, though, that brought tears to Dee's eyes, tears of an unexpected hollowness rather than the rage she'd reckoned with. Oh, she still wanted to claw her hands into Starbuck's shoulders and shake her until she'd beg for forgiveness, teeth rattling, but it didn't seem to matter now. The red-hot fury paled beside the shades of fern and moss, of forest and leafy buds in spring, beside the colors they had lost so very far from here. When she stuffed her fist into her mouth to stifle a sob, Starbuck looked up from the crayon stumps strewn across the floor, from the expanse of greasy wrapping paper splayed around her. Her entire body stiffened. "Hey?" she said. It sounded like a question. Dee wasn't sure whether the other woman was poised for flight or fight. In the end, Starbuck's shoulders slumped, and she continued painting. "That's a holiday resort on Pycon," she said suddenly. Dee recognized the outline of an ochre building amidst the lime-green undergrowth. My mother once took me there for the summer vacation." Her voice trailed off. Almost as an afterthought, she added, "What the frack are you doing here, Dee?" "It's Anna," Dee said, spotting some half-squeezed tubes of oil colors, cornflower blue and gold. When she closed her eyes, she saw her old bedroom window again. "All right then, Anna." Starbuck shuffles to make a little room, and Dee reaches for the paint. So they sit down together, Anna and Kara, and draw houses at the end of the world. The end. This has been a recording of Still Life. If you'd like to leave feedback for the author, Munditia, or for me, you can find those links at my journal, sophonisba.dreamwith.org/tag/podfic. Thank you for listening.